Good evening. I'm Mary Nichols, Dean of the College of Continuing Education, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to tonight, to this month's edition of Headliners. Many of you have been here before. You know that Headliners is a new monthly forum providing opportunities to meet with university experts as they share their firsthand knowledge of the medical breakthroughs, the cultural trends, and foreign affairs that are in the headlines that we read. Tonight, it's a particular pleasure to feature a very distinguished member of the faculty whose research is actually making national news. For the past 60 years, ecologists have been studying how ecosystems function at the university's Cedar Creek Natural History Area. This research has deepened our understanding of biological diversity, climate change, wildlife habitat, and environmental issues, and have regularly put Cedar Creek in the national headlines. Most recently, a research team led by Dave Tillman made another exciting discovery at Cedar Creek, that highly diverse mixtures of native prairie plants could yield more usable biofuel per acre than corn, soybeans, or switchgrass, and could do it without adding to greenhouse gases. Their findings, which were published as the cover story in the December 8th issue of the journal Science, which you see here, has generated enthusiastic media coverage all over the country. Tonight, we're very fortunate to have an opportunity to discuss this exciting discovery with Dave Tillman, one of the world's foremost environmental scientists. A native of Michigan, he received his PhD from the University of Michigan in 1976 and immediately joined the University of Minnesota faculty, where he now serves as Regents Professor, McKnight Presidential Chair in Ecology, and Director of the Cedar Creek Natural History Area. In addition to writing and editing four books and more than 160 scientific papers, he's the founding editor of Issues in Ecology, a publication designed to foster communication among ecologists, the public, and governmental leaders. Among his many honors, he was elected to the National Academy of Sciences in 2002, which many scientists consider second only to winning the Nobel Prize. And the Institute for Scientific Information designated him the most highly cited environmental scientist of the past decade. Fortunately for all of us, he is also a committed public scientist who is willing to take the time to participate in programs like Headliners. Will you please join me in welcoming Professor David Tillman?
Well, it's my pleasure to be here tonight and to see so many of you here. As a professor, I love teaching. And would you please lock the doors? We have a three-hour program tonight. But I don't understand. It's only $10 to get in here? I multiply that out. That's the kind of tuition I was paying in 1971 in the University of Michigan. It's just unbelievable. But it really is great to see so many people interested in if you will, advances in knowledge in all aspects of academia, all aspects of life, which is what Headliners does. And I'm honored deeply that you're here to hear what we've been discovering. I want to just say that science really is a discovery. And I've learned in my career that what I think I'm going to find sometimes is what I find, but it's much more interesting when it's not what I find. And that was very much the case. I did not start the research I'm going to talk about to understand biofuels. I was trying to understand some very fundamental unanswered questions about how ecosystems operate and whether the loss of biological diversity that we have when we manage ecosystems and simplify them and as we drive species extinct might influence how those ecosystems operated, might influence the services they provided to society. And in pursuing that, we bumped into some discoveries that are quite relevant to other issues, bioenergy, food production, and so on. And I want to also just right now acknowledge that this is work that's been done by a large team. In my time at the University of Minnesota, there have probably been 300 or so undergraduates who have worked with me in the last 30 summers doing work, a host of graduate students, of postdoctoral researchers, a large number of faculty researchers. This is team science. It takes great intellectual diversity to try to understand something as complex as natural ecosystems. And it's been my pleasure to have people with me doing this who have very different perspectives and very different skills. The paper was co-authored by three of us, Jason Hill, who's a postdoctoral researcher, and Clarence Lehman, who's a research associate, are two very important parts of this team. And other people on this team, in some sense, Bob Ilde, Dean of Biological Sciences, who saw long before I did the relevance of our research to bioenergy issues. Steve Pulaski, an economist, Doug Tiffany, and other economists have been important members of the team, Sarah Hobby, an ecosystem ecologist, and many, many others. I want to acknowledge all of them because they all have contributed to what I'm talking with you tonight about. Well, what made me interested in bioenergy was that it was butting up against two of my other interests. And let me talk about this. If we look at, this is a graph, and I'll be showing lots of graphs tonight. I'm a graphing kind of person, so if you're not, I will always explain these verbally, and hopefully it'll all make sense. But this just shows how much energy the world has been consuming from 1970 to the present time and projecting out where we're going to go. And if you look at what's happened, global energy consumption has doubled in the last 35 years, and I would say conservative estimates are that it will double again in the next 40 years. And there are clearly concerns about how we can obtain this energy, the price that we pay to obtain it, the price that we pay when we use it in terms of the impacts of using it, and so on. And those that need for much greater energy collides with another major need, which has been a greater interest of mine. I'm interested not only in ecology, but also in agriculture. The two are very closely linked. And have studied past trends. The Green Revolution, led by Borlaug from the University of Minnesota, helped us double global food production in 35 years, which is a very important feat, one which allowed millions and millions of people to live productive lives who otherwise would have had insufficient food to develop themselves and even to live. The projections are that with 3 billion more people coming our way before our global human population levels off, and with per capita incomes going up and people biasing diets toward meat when they're richer, which happens all around the world, we're going to have to double food production again, even though population is only going to go up 50%. So here we're going to have to double energy. We're going to have to double food. And there are suggestions that we should use land, biofuels, to do both. Well, I'm not going to go through how much land there's left on Earth, but basically, if you looked at how much land there was in various forms that could be usable for agriculture, there's about 5 billion acres being used right now. There's about 3 billion more available before we cut down all the rest of the native ecosystems on fertile land. And that's the end of it. We don't have land to double agriculture if we double agriculture by having twice as much land. We definitely don't have land to do that and to make biofuels. So we have a conflict, if you will. We have need for more energy and trying to provide it in a sustainable, environmentally friendly manner that doesn't cause other problems. That coming to a head with the need for more food and how we're going to produce that food. These are two major challenges. The third major challenge that ties up with this is that of global climate change. This shows levels of CO2 that have been in the atmosphere. This is from ice cores taken from a lake in Antarctica called Vostok, Lake Vostok. And you can go down and you can take cores of ice deeper and deeper, drill deeper and deeper, and you can measure carbon dioxide in them and see what was in the atmosphere when that snow fell and froze a little bubble of air. And this shows what happened, and the peaks where CO2 is high are all the periods that we call interglacials, or times like now when the Earth is warm. And the troughs when carbon dioxide was low were times when there were glaciers. And if you look at what's been happening here, up until the present, you can see there were some fairly regular cycles, and now what has happened, we have entered a period of higher levels of CO2 than we've ever had in the last 400,000 years. We've entered totally uncharted territory for what is going to happen to global climate. And so this is happening because our lifestyle, the way we live, the way we produce food and everything else, is using so much fossil fuel, releasing so much carbon dioxide that we have elevated atmospheric levels of CO2, a major potent greenhouse gas, to points that for which we have no way to understand what it implies except by mathematical models or by waiting and seeing what happens. And so right now we're sort of in the wait-and-see mode, I would assert, which may not be a very wise mode, but that's what we're in right now. We don't know what it implies. You know, this is the warmest year ever for the United States, the third warmest year ever for the world, that we've had the majority of the warm year records in the last decade. If you look at climate in the last couple hundred years, there's been a major warming trend, one that actually outstrips predictions of the models we have that are trying to predict global climate. But this is another constraint. We're going to try to meet increasing global energy demands without having massive increases in greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide in the air. That is a huge challenge, and also to at the same time meet our food needs. And so these are the interests that drew me into biofuels. Is there a way, might there be a way, in which biofuels could be produced that could provide energy that we need, that could help meet our environmental needs by slowing or reducing carbon dioxide levels, greenhouse gas levels, without having strong competition with our need for food, and also without destroying a lot of the remaining native ecosystems of the world, and by destroying them, causing extinction of a large number of species. These are the forces that we now face when there are 6 billion people heading toward 9 billion people living on a planet, people who consume more now than any individuals ever consumed before in the history of human life. These are sort of the unintended consequences of where we are. And I'd like to show you a role that biofuels might be able to play. I said this was a journey of discovery. And one of the first questions we asked in trying to see what we were up against was to look at current biofuels and ask, what are we getting right now from these first-generation biofuels? Right now, we're taking food and converting it into energy. We need both food and energy. It doesn't seem like a very wise long-term policy, but let's just look what happens when we turn corn into ethanol and soybeans into biodiesel. So now I have some graphs. And what I want to say is that what we're trying to do is to do what is called full cost accounting or life cycle accounting. If you go to an ethanol factory, you'll see coming out of that factory 400 gallons of ethanol for the corn produced on a single acre of farmland. That's pretty impressive, 400 gallons per acre, if you will. But what you don't see is how much fossil energy was used to produce that ethanol. And what's shown here under the red boxes is fossil and the arrow pointing down. That's a bar that shows how much energy in units that sound like they're from Back to the Future. These are only megajoules, not gigajoules. But units of energy are required to produce the ethanol, and their inputs for diesel fuel on a farm and inputs to make fertilizer and so on and inputs to process that corn and make the ethanol. And the other side, the orange-yellow bar above corn there, or the bar above soybean, the red bar above soybeans, is the net amount of energy in the biofuel that is made. The difference between those two bars are the gains in energy. And what you can see is that little green box above corn ethanol is the proportion of that ethanol in a tanker leaving that ethanol factory that is actually new energy. What it used to be was diesel fuel that a farmer used. It was natural gas used to distill the alcohol from the mash that was fermented. Only 20% of the energy in that truck is actually new energy. The rest of it is just turning diesel into ethanol. Now, we're gaining something. We do have that 20% of that gallon of each gallon that is new energy. So there actually is a return on investment. It's not a very large return, but this is a first-generation biofuel. These are brand new things. I don't say this to criticize where we are. I say this to point out how we can do this better. I am interested in having these processes become much more efficient, and I want to show you how we can do that. So 20% of each gallon of ethanol is new energy. 48% of each gallon of biodiesel is new energy because of all the various energy inputs. You can also look at some other inputs. Corn is a very nutrient-hungry plant. It takes an immense amount of nitrogen fertilizer, which has a lot of energy in it. That's why bombs are made out of nitrogen compounds. That's the energy being released that it took to make the fertilizer in the first place. And this shows the two bars. The red bar you can't see is how much fertilizer, nitrogen fertilizer, is applied to produce a unit of energy of soybean biodiesel. And the orange bar is how much is used to make ethanol from corn. And so there's a huge input of nitrogen, much of which ends up in the groundwater, lakes, rivers, and streams, and is a major pollutant for making corn ethanol, much greater than for making soybean biodiesel. The same thing is true for phosphorus, P, another element that can be a major polluter of groundwaters. Corn ethanol has a very large impact per unit of energy gained in terms of its effects on groundwater quality and lakes and rivers and stream quality. Plus, corn has to be babied in a large number of ways. It requires lots of pesticide input to grow corn compared to soybeans. And so when we looked at these things, we saw how much energy it was requiring, how much fertilizer, how much pesticide. We wondered if there might not be a way to actually gain at least as much energy without having these by trying an approach to growing energy crops is very different from how we grow agricultural crops. In agriculture, we have immense inputs to get out high yields of food. We put in non-food things, energy, fertilizer, and pesticides, to get a lot of food. We need the food. Well, if we're going to produce energy, what we care about is how much energy we put in per unit of energy out. If we put in 80 bushels of corn to get back 100 bushels of corn the next year, we wouldn't feel like we're doing much good. But we're putting in 80 units of energy to get back 100 units of energy a year later. So I think that what we're suggesting is there might be another approach. And the other, I guess the other issue in this is greenhouse gases. You can burn a gallon of gasoline in your car or a gallon of diesel fuel, and you'll get out the amount of carbon dioxide, a greenhouse gas shown here. And you'll notice the amount you get out if you burn corn ethanol, when you go across this whole life cycle, is a little bit less. It's about 14% less CO2 goes in the air if you burn corn grain ethanol than if you burn gasoline. That's because, and most of that CO2 goes in the air in the farming and the distillation process to make the ethanol, not from your tailpipe. But it gives you about a 14% benefit. Soy biodiesel gives you about a 40% greenhouse gas benefit. So that's where we stand right now. Now, I want to give you one last insight into where we are right now on current biofuels. Let's say you took all the corn we grow in the United States, you took all the soybeans we grow in the United States, and converted them into energy. And you use the ethanol to replace gasoline. You would displace 12% of the energy we currently use in gasoline with that ethanol. But of that 12%, or of that total amount of energy displaced, only 2.5% is actually new energy. Every single grain of corn in the country being used to make ethanol, and you only get 2.5% of the energy is new energy of the amount that we currently use for gasoline. Do the same thing for diesel, it's 3% new energy. It's an immense cost to food production for what is really a trivial gain in terms of energy to society. And that is such a low gain because we put so much energy into growing the corn and so much fossil energy into transforming it into a biofuel. So what we thought was that a better path or a path toward better biofuels might be to consider not high input monoculture production of feedstocks, but low input and, as I'll show you in a minute, high diversity. Really the opposite of how we do agriculture now. Very low inputs we're suggesting and using biological diversity as a tool. I'll show you why that works in a minute. And so it'd be nice to have a feedstock that you could produce with very low inputs, low fertilizer, pesticides, and so on. It'd be even better if that could grow on land that is of marginal agricultural value. So you don't have the need for bioenergy going head-to-head with the need for food. And it'd be even better if, in doing that, there was some way that some carbon dioxide could be, if you will, removed from the air and stored at least enough to compensate for how much carbon dioxide is released by the fossil fuels you must use to grow that biomass and transform it into an energy source. And it was thinking this that led us to go back to an experiment started for a totally different reason in this sort of zigzagged path of discovery I'm talking about at Cedar Creek Natural History Area, an experiment that occupies about 20 acres. Each plot you see here is about 30 by 30 feet in size, 9 by 9 meters in size. There are actually a couple different experiments here all randomly interspaced. The one I want to talk about is an experiment in which we changed the number of plant species, of prairie perennial species, growing in individual plots. We had some plots that we planted with one species, some with two, some with four, some with eight, some with 16. So we changed the number of species, and each plot we randomly chose which species we put in it. So we could average across the effects of different compositions of species and find out, on average, does it matter if an ecosystem has two species or four or eight or 16 or one? Does the biological diversity of a system matter? And we know in economic systems, diversity of an economy affects its stability, and there's some work suggesting it affects its productivity. But when we started this work, no one in ecology knew the answer to this question. In fact, most people in ecology thought this was a question not worth asking. When I started this experiment, people said, don't you remember that was rejected 25 years ago? It's an old idea. It's gone. And nobody believes it anymore. Well, we tried it and found out what happened. Here is what happens. So every dot here is data from a given plot. So, and we sample only a little strip from each plot, 4 inches wide and about 10 feet long. So it's only a small sample. There's noise and so on when you sample a small part of a whole plot. But the poster child here, and this is the other thing which got us interested in biofuels, was switchgrass. You've probably all heard of switchgrass. It was talked about by President Bush in his last State of the Union address, talking about it is a better way to produce energy, and he is totally correct. It is a much better way to produce energy than corn grain ethanol. I had imagined the switchgrass might have been chosen to be the poster child for perennial grassland bioenergy production because it was better than everything else. And so when we looked at our three replicate switchgrass plots, monocultures, and graphed them with everything else, the green dot shows what switchgrass looks like, I was surprised that he was just at the average of all of these 16 species in our plots. There's nothing special about what it does by itself, growing without fertilizer, without irrigation, without pesticides, and so on, because we don't have those kind of inputs in our experiment. This is a natural ecosystem, species doing whatever they do all on their own on a degraded, agriculturally nutrient-poor soil. But if you look across here, what you can see is that this curve goes up, this curve that fits these data. The high-diversity plots, the plots planted with 16 species, on average produce 238% more energy than does switchgrass or than does the average plot planted with a single species. So we had no idea there'd be this much of a premium of biological diversity. We had reasons to believe from mathematical theory, I won't go into tonight unless you really want to pay more tuition, that something like that might happen. There's good theoretical reasons to believe you'll have a curve that looks like this. This experiment caused a lot of controversy. It's been repeated more than 100 times around the world. A recent paper summarizing, doing a meta-analysis of all those experiments that came out of Nature a couple months ago, said on average, high-diversity areas compared to monocultures are about twice as productive. Ours is about three times as productive. But our experiment's gone longer, and our plots have become more and more productive through time, shown here. So not only did we initially see that high diversity led to greater productivity, what we saw is that advantage of diversity actually has grown through time from the high diversity plots being about twice as productive as monocultures to now them being about four times as productive as monocultures. So we're getting much more bioenergy on this land. Now I want to say something else. There's a bit of a controversy about the work that's going on, controversy going on right now. We grew these plants without any inputs of any sort. We didn't fertilize and so on. And that led to a question, could we actually have sustainable yields without having to fertilize? Well, in our analyses, we imagined we'd have to put back in every year how much nutrient, nitrogen, phosphorus, and calcium there is in the plants that we harvest. It turns out, though, we harvest we propose in this paper harvesting in late autumn when the plants have drawn nutrients back to the roots, the plants are brown and so on, they're dried out. It's a very good time to harvest them. And there actually isn't a lot of nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, and so on left in the tissue. So it wouldn't take that much fertilizer to replace it. And you could do that, for instance, by putting ash from combusting this biomass back on the field as to replace the nutrients that were lost. But it led me to remember some other studies I've known about. For instance, there are three counties in Kansas in which much of the land has been unbroken, but it's been farmed for a long time, for over 100 years, just for hay. The hay is unfertilized. And this shows yields on average for these three counties of hay over a 65-year period without fertilizer being added to this land, without it being irrigated. The hay yields go up and down a bit. You should see alfalfa, it really goes up and down. High-diversity mixtures are actually more stable, and they've been able to maintain production despite this biomass being taken off. And then I worked for a while in a place in England called Rothamsted, an experimental research agricultural research station, and there's a pasture that has been mown for hay with some control plots that were never fertilized, other plots that proved that fertilizer actually made plants grow faster. They discovered fertilizer in these experiments in the 1840s and 50s. These plots are still running. Hay has been cut twice a year and removed from these plots from 1856 to the present time. It's been weighed every year and so on. And the bottom graph shows these hay yields, and in fact, they're actually going up. No fertilizer ever for 150 years now. Yields are actually going up slightly. They're going up because legumes are becoming more abundant because livestock aren't eating. It was typical British fashion before it was made in this experiment. It was first used as pasture for 400 years. That's really how Brits do everything. You get over there, you'll understand. So I still think that we have to be adding some nutrients back in, but the reality looks like because we harvest at a time that there aren't big outputs and so on, it looks like we don't take a lot to sustain it. So let's look at what happens here if we look at the prairie biomass that's produced and what we end up getting for our energy yield. So this shows the data for corn ethanol and soybean biodiesel I showed you before. In the first two bars on the left-hand side, the first two double bars. And the other bars, look at what happens if you take prairie biomass and you take the harvested biomass and convert it into electricity, which you can do by burning it in a current coal-fired electric generating facility. They can take up to about 10% biomass and mix it with coal and do it. You can see the blue bar there for biomass electricity shows the amount of electricity you get in energy. That's the output. And the input is the input needed to grow and harvest this prairie biomass. The inputs are very small. You don't fertilize it. You do have to run a tractor across and harvest it. The difference between those two is the energy gain. The same thing is true if you take that prairie biomass and turn it into ethanol. You can do that because the biomass has in it compounds called cellulose. These are strings of sugars hooked together in a long chain. It's a polymer of sugars. That's what plant walls are made out of. And there are enzymes that break those apart into the sugars. So you can break that cellulose down into sugars, feed the sugars to yeast or to bacteria that will ferment it to alcohol, and then you're on the same path you are for corn alcohol. You just distill that alcohol out and get the energy. And the last thing you can do, or there are many things, but another thing you can do, which actually turns out to be the most efficient process we know right now to turn biomass into energy, you can gasify it. You put it under 30 atmospheres of pressure in a big chamber. You heat it up. You break biomass, which is basically a carbon, two hydrogens, and an oxygen, down into carbon monoxide, CO, plus hydrogen gas, H2. Then you take that CO and the H2 and you put it across a catalyst, which has iron and cobalt in it, and that catalyst joins these carbons together in chains, and it builds up things that are called octane and pentane, the exact chemical compounds that make up gasoline, and longer chains, the exact chemical compounds that make up diesel fuel. So you can break this biomass down into carbon monoxide and hydrogen and build it back up into these long chains. You save the energy you need for distillation, which is why making ethanol doesn't give us as much energy as you might hope, because it takes so much energy to distill that alcohol off of it. And the net gain is the largest net gain of all of these processes. I'll show you that here. So the upper purple bars show you the net energy gain from making corn grain ethanol, soy biodiesel, and so on in terms of these units of gain per acre. For scaling, the net gain bar for corn grain alcohol is about 80 gallons of ethanol per acre, if you want to look at that bar. Imagine that bar is 80 gallons of ethanol per acre, and that scales to all the other ones. And the energy equivalent for the syn-fuel gasoline and diesel you get out from the gasification process is around 120 gallons of net energy gained per acre. So it turns out by minimizing the energy cost of these inputs and by eliminating this cost of distillation for the ethanol, that you can actually gain more energy growing high-diversity prairie mixtures, which basically take care of themselves, mow them once a year for hay, transform that hay into gases and the gases into various petrochemicals. You can gain more energy doing that because you minimize all these input costs than you can using very fertile land, the most fertile land we have, to grow corn and turning the corn into ethanol. Now, something else in the lower bar shows another point, which I want to get to, and this shows what happens to greenhouse gases. And the height of each of these lower bars is how greenhouse gas emissions have been affected, in this case reduced, all these are reductions, by these different processes. There's a little bit of reduction in greenhouse gas from corn grain ethanol compared to burning an energy equivalent amount of gasoline. A little reduction for soybean compared to burning an energy equivalent amount of soy biodiesel. There's a pretty big reduction compared to how we normally make electricity. 80% of our electric comes from coal. This is a reduction compared to how we make electricity in the United States, the greenhouse gases. So there's a much bigger reduction compared to that, and a much bigger reduction for the biomass into ethanol and into syn fuels. And in fact, this reduction happens because these prairie plants, when they grow, we're growing them on degraded soils. Degraded soils lost a lot of their carbon. The biggest store of carbon on Earth is in ocean sediments. So the carbon dioxide that used to be in the atmosphere was taken up by algae and it ends up in the sediments. That's been going on for billions of years. That's its biggest store of carbon. The second biggest store of carbon on Earth are in soils. 40% of all of the carbon dioxide released to the atmosphere in the last 100 years has come because of farming, increasing rates of decomposition of organic matter in soil, releasing carbon that had been in the soil, turning it into carbon dioxide because of metabolism, releasing that gas to the air. 60% came from fossil fuels. 40% actually comes from farming. I would assert it's well worth it. We have to eat. But if you take abandoned, degraded land, and we have about 34 million acres of this in the United States is currently enrolled as CRP land, Conservation Reserve Program land, plant it with high diversity mixtures of native species. These species restore the soil back to the conditions that it was before farming. They created the soil in the first place. Put them back in there, they recreate the soil again. It's about 150 to 200 year process to recreate the soil. In doing so, they store very large concentrations of carbon in the soil. They remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, put it in their roots. The roots die, shed, they decompose slowly. They build up carbon that had been in the air in the soil. The amount that's built up is surprisingly large. This is the amount, a megagram, MG, is a ton. It's a 1.1 U.S. ton. It's a metric ton. HA is a hectare. It's 2.47 acres. I'll convert these in a minute, but just to let you know what these are. And this shows how much carbon actually ends up in these dense root systems of prairie plants in the soil. And there's a large amount of carbon, 1.5 or so tons per hectare, ends up in these root systems. Even more ends up building up, this is per year, in these soils through time. And the net effect, this shows how diversity affects this rate of accumulation of carbon. The high diversity plots are storing a lot of carbon, about 3 tons per hectare per year. The monocultures, we have no detectable storage. Switchgrass, no detectable storage of carbon in the soil. There are huge benefits, if you will, here from the productivity that comes from these high diversity plots. Well, what does this say? This says that we have tons of carbon dioxide being removed from the atmosphere, put into the soil as these plants grow and restore the soil, and this will keep going on for about 100 or so years, 100 to 200 years. And that led us to wonder something. This is sort of the last major discovery, something we never imagined when we started doing these analyses. Turned out to be so. It just shocked us when we saw it. The amount of carbon dioxide that you release to the atmosphere when you plant the prairie, we only plant it once, it lives basically forever. They're long-lived perennial plants, they reseed themselves. And then the amount that you have to release every year to mow it, you mow it once for hay in late autumn when everything's brown. The amount it takes to bale that, to load it with a forklift onto a flatbed truck, and to haul it 50 miles away to a processing plant is shown here. It's about 0.3 tons of CO2 for every hectare of land that you farm. We're having storage of 4.4 tons of CO2 in the soils for every hectare of land that you farm for every year. That means we have about 4 metric tons for every hectare. That's 1.8 U.S. tons per acre of carbon dioxide removed from the atmosphere, stored in the soil, that is in excess of all the amount that is released to the air by all the fossil fuel you burn. So when you have that biomass, the carbon dioxide in the biomass had been taken out of the air. When you burn it, it'll go back in. The biomass is irrelevant. The net equation, if you will, the part that matters, is that there's this net storage going on in the soil. And the net storage is so large that by the time you harvest this biomass, convert it into biofuels, and burn the biofuels, you have less carbon dioxide in the air than you had before you started the process. They're called carbon-negative biofuels. This is the first example of carbon-negative biofuels. These are massively, surprisingly large negative amounts of, if you will, carbon dioxide being removed from the atmosphere by this very process. So, in conclusion, what we have shown by looking at this process is that there is an alternative to the way that we've been thinking about producing bioenergy. It is not going to be the only alternative. This is an area where there's immense amount of research. Lots of people are having lots of new ideas day by day by day. New things are coming out. It's a really fun area to be working in because of this. There are many, many discoveries going on. What we've discovered is that we can actually get more energy from an acre of land by minimizing inputs, by using degraded land, but by using the benefits of high biological diversity, which gives us more net production of energy per acre that then can be converted into a greater net amount of fuel. And in doing so, we have some really surprisingly large environmental benefits. These fuels are carbon negative, as I've said. We have less CO2 in the air when you're done with the whole process and have burned the fuel than you had beforehand. They're very sustainable systems. You don't have to put inputs into these systems. I think in the long term, you will have to add something to replace the nutrients it removes. I think you have to maybe recycle the ash. Will end up being a very important part of it in the long term. But they're very sustainable. They're very stable. We have other work that has shown that high diversity systems are much more stable. These, because they don't have all these inputs, they don't leach much nutrient into the groundwater. In fact, these prairie plants are so efficient, these high-diversity systems are so efficient at producing biomass because the plants differ from each other in when and where they forage for nitrate and phosphate in the soil. And these mixtures reduce the concentration of nitrate and phosphate dissolved in the groundwater to much lower levels than even the monocultures of these prairie plants, like switchgrass does. Switchgrass leaves about 3 times more nitrate unconsumed in the soil than do these high-diversity mixtures. And that's one reason why these high-diversity mixtures are more productive. They're better at extracting these resources from the system. That gives us cleaner groundwaters and rivers and so on. I want to emphasize that this whole idea of low-input, high-diversity is, in some ways, it's a very old idea, but right now it's back to being a new idea. But it's not a cure-all. It is one new idea that can give us advantages compared to how we're doing things. I would assert it is an important next step in having us find ways to develop sustainable biofuels, and which has to be only one part of a lifestyle which is much more sustainable than our overall lifestyle is right now. I think many of the insights that we had that allowed us to find these discoveries came down to looking at the full costs and the full benefits. If you owned an ethanol factory, you would see 400 gallons of ethanol going out per acre, and you might not think that it took 320 energy equivalent gallons of fossil fuel to produce it. It's not so obvious to you. You're not an ecologist, you're not a scientist, you're buying a factory, you're making money, it sort of looks good. You're producing this renewable fuel. Well, there are things, and it is good, but there are things you can do that are much, much better. And you don't really discover what is better until you look at all of the costs and all of the benefits. Look at the energy costs, the economic costs, the environmental costs, and the benefits in all three of those areas, and try to balance those. And moreover, you need to balance not just those costs and benefits. You have to ask energy, food, and the environment simultaneously. In the long term, we have to have a way that we can meet all three of these very major human needs. I think that this idea has great potential. I don't know how far it will go. But I also have many questions about it, and I'm hoping you have lots of questions. I would love to talk with you. I love to talk either way to myself or to you. You may have noticed. If this idea works with about the same efficiency in other ecosystems around the world, we know how productive other native ecosystems are. We know how productive abandoned lands are. We have a pretty good estimate of how much abandoned land there is, land that's been farmed and abandoned or been deforested and abandoned or overgrazed and abandoned around the world. And our estimates are that on a global basis, using this land to produce biofuels with the gasification process, which is the most efficient process, we could meet about 13% of our current gasoline and diesel needs for the world and about 19% of our current electricity needs for the world simultaneously, both of those at the same time. So there's an important question is asked, do other ecosystems actually respond this way? Can we find mixtures of native plants that can give us the same benefits in the sub-Saharan Africa that we find in the prairies of Minnesota? We don't know the answer. No one has tried it. This paper came out December 8th. Until then, no one knew about this. So it's a new idea. It'll take time to have this work be explored, and I guarantee there'll be many people who will raise very interesting questions about this work as it enters the discussion mode among scientists. In fact, I had somebody call me yesterday who was thinking about, well, maybe he could find ways to breed all these native plants and make them better at doing this. I don't know if that happened. I wondered, well, with 3.5 billion years of natural selection, what's he going to achieve? Now, if you take a plant out of nature, corn was a wild plant that lived in nature, with many other species around it, grow it in monoculture. We found when you take something from nature and grow it in monoculture, you can make it much better. But can you actually breed something that'll be much better growing in competition with all these other species? I'm not sure. It'll be fun to find out. I'm sure we will find out because someone's going to try it. What would happen if we didn't grow these on degraded soil but did on fertile soils? Will we still have all the benefits of carbon storage? Even fertile soils that have been farmed have lost about half of their carbon in the first 50 years of farming. So there might be a big carbon benefit there. What if you fertilized it? What if you went to a high input, high diversity? Could you maintain diversity? Would it still work? Would nutrients start leaking out into the ecosystem? Would you have the carbon stores? I don't know, but I guarantee somebody's going to try fertilizing this and see if we'll have to find out what's going to happen to know. Forests. I've been talking about grasslands. Lots of the world is covered with forests, and the natural plants that would be most productive in those climates and soils would be forested habitats. Can they do the same thing? Does plant diversity matter in forests? We don't know the answer. There are three experiments right now going in the world. Trees, unfortunately, grow much more slowly than prairie plants. So it'll be 20 years before we really know. At least 10 years before we get a hint. But we'll get a hint. And we'll find out. And then you can ask, let's be practical. Let's say that you are a farmer with 1,000 acres of grassland. Maybe it's in a conservation reserve program and you've retired and you're getting your $50 or whatever it is an acre from it and you're living on that. That grassland biomass could be harvested and used to produce biofuels. Will the Farm Bill allow that? Right now you can't. The Farm Bill would not let you do that. Should society let that happen? What are the costs and what are the benefits? CRP land has wildlife benefits. It has other conservation benefits. How do you trade those off? Is there a trade-off? Questions like this aren't yet fully understood, to be quite frank, because no one had thought about doing this for bioenergy until very recently. And then you can ask this. Let's say a farmer wanted to do this, wanted to produce high-diversity biomass in ways that would store carbon and help reduce the levels of greenhouse gas in the atmosphere, things that would give us cleaner groundwaters and so on, reduce pesticide loading. How does that farmer stay in business? What is required? How much can he sell his biomass for? Who will buy it? Who will transport it to places? Who will actually convert it into fuels? What will those fuels sell for? If to make this work, society has to pay more to have an environmentally friendly fuel that doesn't cause global climate change, is that something that we're willing to do? Europe is doing it right now with the Kyoto Treaty, but the United States hasn't adopted that. But I don't think that many farmers will find that they make more money doing this, growing prairie hay, than they do make growing corn. Although there's some interesting analyses that suggest it might not be as far apart as you might guess, because it costs about $200 an acre to grow corn, about $30 an acre to grow prairie hay. Then you have to look at the yields. And it takes about 2 to 5 weeks of labor per year to grow 1,000 acres of hay, but it takes several people to grow a comparable amount of corn. So there's lots of difference in inputs and capitalization. We don't know the answer to these questions, but they're all very important questions as we go, if you will, from where we are right now. A new discovery, we're sort of walking into our field of dreams as one of my summer interns disappearing into one of the areas we were harvesting to see how much bioenergy would have as we go from this field of dreams to reality. Thank you.
Wow, is that not one of the most hopeful things we've heard for a long time? Professor Tillman, thank you very much. Well, as those of you who have been to Headliners know, we're going to circulate in the audience with some microphones and give you a chance to ask questions of David Tillman. And if you don't mind, be sure to state your question clearly into the microphone. We're actually recording the proceedings tonight on a microphone that works. Is that better? We'll have it online tomorrow, so you can either listen or download, and so can anybody else who's around. So for that reason, please put your questions into the mic. So let's see, over here. Thank you.
Yeah, I have a question. In the actual conversion of this into fuels, is anyone doing this? I don't mean this prairie grass, but switchgrass. I mean something other than biomass, other than soybean or corn, these more primitive. Because it seemed to me that the question of coming up with appropriate yeast or bacteria that can make these conversions, is that currently available?
That's a very good question. And one of the troubles with doing any area of endeavor is you know it way too well and you don't remember to tell people all of the caveats. So here are a list of caveats. Right now, the most efficient way we know to make a biofuel is either by converting soybean oil into biodiesel or corn sugars into ethanol, or even better, sugars from sugarcane into ethanol. The technology to convert cellulose into alcohol exists, but the enzymes to do it, to break it down, are right now too expensive. The estimates are that in 5 to 7 years, from this Department of Energy reports on this, it'll be cheaper to make alcohol, ethanol, from biomass, from the cellulose and biomass, than it will be to make it from corn. We're not there right now. There are two commercial plants in operation, one more being built. One's in Spain, one's in Canada, one someplace in the U.S., to do that conversion of cellulose into alcohol. So it is now being, for the first time, being scaled up to a commercial level. And we will see, I mean, there will be a lot of shakedown in any new process. But all indications are the people who work on this are convinced that this will end up being a much more efficient process. And one of the big advantages is that When you digest cellulose, you have left behind some compounds, lignin, and remember there's something called lignite coal. Lignin is a plant compound that is, when you burn it, gives a lot of energy. You can actually use that, burn that, to drive the distillation process and get rid of where we currently use natural gas to do the distillation. So you displace a fossil fuel and put in a renewable energy source. And we can do that right now by burning prairie grasses in place of natural gas for the production of ethanol from coal, from corn, and that would help that process too. But now the other issue is the gasification process. Gasification is actually a very old technology. But gasifying biomass to get syn fuels is, I don't know if it's being done commercially now, but I know there are places that it is being proposed and being started. It's actually a process that Germany used in World War II. When they're cut off from oil, they turn coal into syn fuels, diesel and gasoline, and use it to power their society. So it's actually a very old technology, and it's really off the shelf. You can buy gasifiers pre-made. You can buy all the different parts you need to do it and assemble a factory. The issue there is having the right price for oil, that you make more profit doing that than just buying oil and refining oil.
We have a question up front here. Go ahead.
Do you have any insight into the emissions of other chemicals, such as nitrogen oxides or particulate matter, from the grasslands?
When we listed greenhouse gases, we actually included not only carbon dioxide but all other known greenhouse gases as carbon dioxide equivalents. And so nitrous oxide is another greenhouse gas that is emitted from growing corn and also from prairie. Actually, prairie actually does a bit more consuming it than emitting it, but we actually included all those in it. So when I said greenhouse gases or CO2 equivalent, I was implying that we had done the survey across all of the greenhouse gases. Now, particulates, if you gasify, there really aren't particulates. You do this in a closed chamber at 30 atmospheres pressure. You don't have, it's not like an open combustion stack or a fluidized bed reactor in a coal-fired plant where you actually have a chimney carrying gases away and particles away. I say the one thing we really haven't looked into as much as I wish we had is the whole water issue. How much water is used making ethanol, growing corn, and so on versus alternatives. That's a very important issue that we just haven't jumped into yet.
Let me go to this side of the room here.
Oh, there's one over here.
Okay. The center first?
Yes. How does Brazil's sugarcane biofuel efforts, yields and efficiencies compare?
I haven't found as rigorous analysis on that as I would like, but the Brazil sugarcane is much more efficient for a few reasons. First, you have more sugar per acre, much more sugar per acre being produced. And secondly, when you squeeze the sugar out of the sugarcane, the leftover stalks are a very good energy source. Those are actually burned at the plant to provide all the energy needed to do the distillation, all the energy to run the plant, and actually they have excess energy that is sold onto the grid as electricity from that. Now, you could have some of those benefits by doing the same thing, let's say, with leftover parts of corn, like a corn cob or corn stalks. It's called corn stover. Using those as a fuel can get rid of some of the fossil fuel currently being used to make ethanol. The unknown part there is that all soils have carbon in them that is there because of an equilibrium, because of how much biomass comes in. The leftover corn parts come into the field every year and start decaying, and how much leaves by decomposition. If you quit putting that corn biomass into the soil, you'll lose carbon in the soil, just like we've lost, I said, 40% of our CO2 emissions come from farmland. After 50 or so years, farmland reaches a new equilibrium, and it no longer is a net emitter of carbon dioxide. But if you get rid of that corn stover on cornfields, you'll start having those fields be net emitters of carbon dioxide again for another 50 years until they reach a new equilibrium. And that may not be a very pleasant equilibrium for how low the soil carbon might be in those soils.
Let's go over here, please. Yes, go ahead.
Yes, I'm wondering if there's been a response on what it's been from the Minnesota legislature and the governor, what the response has been to your findings, and then if there are any plans to start growing this and processing maybe an IRE-funded something, maybe U of M, Morris, something to get a plant that might be able to do this.
Well, that's a great question. Before this, I began this talk, I was bemoaning that in science it only takes 20 years for an idea to work its way to the public. And so I just love the thought that you want a governor to know something that was published on December 8th and be doing something about it. It's just wonderful. I just love that optimism. It's fabulous. It's just a wonderful idea. But in fact, I haven't heard from the governor, and I have heard from the U.S. Department of State, from the Senate Ag Committee, U.S. Senate Ag Committee, the U.S. Senate Energy Committee, and from members of the state legislature. And so, actually, I think the fortunate thing for this idea, it has been communicated fairly widely by the media, and it means that the idea is out there in play, and that's all you can ever ask as a scientist. I want people who make decisions to know this information and to use it as wise as they can. I'm not an expert on policy. There are lots of things to be weighed back and forth. Anyway, I just your optimism is just fabulous. I love it.
Let's go over here, and then we have one in the middle.
Yes, Professor Tillman, I was wondering what reactions you've had, recognizing it's early, from the global energy companies, ExxonMobil and Royal Dutch Shell and so forth. They would seem like they might see this as a threat.
I have not had any comments from them. But on that side, British Petroleum is actually very much on the other side of the equation. I'll be at a meeting in Princeton, Princeton University. British Petroleum has funded an energy group at Princeton with maybe $25 million or so so far that is doing work that is trying to help BP become an energy company that provides renewable energy with no greenhouse gas impacts. Lots of different ideas. I gave a talk on this work as it was just falling into place last March or April, something like that, last year in Princeton. I was meeting with the people in the energy group, and we've been collaborating since then. I think in the long term, energy companies, to make money, are going to have to provide the full package, and the full package will be a source of energy provided in a way that doesn't have long-term damaging effects upon society. And I think that BP is ahead of the curve right now. I think General Electric and some other ways are ahead of the curve for U.S. companies. I think the companies that are ahead of the curve are probably going to make more profit in the long term. At least I hope so. That's my hypothesis.
I can hope so. Let's go in the center here.
In the last 2 years, there's been a lot of...
In the last few years, there's been a lot of effort to restore natural prairie grasses. How does the variety of plants that are used in that replanting natural prairie grasses compare with your 36 varieties of plants that you've been using?
Well, the person who's shown here, this is Maria Jose, one of our students this summer. Maria and Julia, two of our students, discovered where they were with the help of various sources, 43 different sites in Minnesota, North and South Dakota, Wisconsin, and Iowa, where we had recently restored prairie, 10 years old or younger, by CRP land. And we looked at how productive the CRP land was, how productive the prairie was, and we were delighted that the farmers who owned the CRP gave us permission and the CRP agency gave us permission to do the sampling work on them. And we saw that the prairie as it's typically planted wasn't, even the restored prairies weren't as diverse as what we see in native prairie. But the restored prairies were about 30 to 40% more productive than the CRP land on similar soil right by them was. So there was a premium in that case from the diversity. What they lacked compared to our plantings, one thing which really gave our system a big boost, and it's no surprise if you know agronomy, is legumes. Native legumes are very important. These soils not only lose a lot of carbon, they lose a lot of nitrogen. And having some native legumes in this mixture turned out to be a very important part of all the benefits that we saw. It made them more productive. When you do analyses and ask what controls the rate of storage of carbon in the soil, a big factor is how many legume species are there and how many of the native prairie perennial grasses are there. Those two factors together, more species of each of those, gives us more carbon being stored in the soil. And so what I'd say is that there's been a lot of prairie restored in Minnesota, a lot, it could be a lot more, 15,000-20,000 acres is not a lot across the whole state. That's maybe what it is. And it is a beautiful new habitat that's sort of getting back to the way it was, but it's nowhere near as diverse as it had been. And the mix really should be biased toward having more legumes. If it's really going to be maximizing storage of carbon and maximizing biomass production for bioenergy.
Thank you. Let's go over here.
Professor Tillman, I'm in the banking business, and I'd like you to give me your opinion on one of the phenomena we see right now, especially in small farming communities, is a rush to build more ethanol plants. It's profitable right now while fuel is as priced as high as it is. But I wonder, on a more long-range view, in these small communities that are putting a lot of capital investment in these ethanol plants, if the product mix has changed to something like this, will those plants still be economically viable, or will it require something totally different in storage and processing?
Let me start by saying it's a very important question, and it's not my area of expertise. At the university, there's some better people to answer that question. Doug Tiffany, one of my collaborators, is much more knowledgeable about that question. Let me tell you what I think I've learned from him and some others on that. I look on what's happening right now as a very hopeful sign, in that people, there's a chance to make money and do good at the same time, if you will. And that's a wonderful situation. But if the Department of Energy projections are correct, that in about 5 or so years, it'll be cheaper to make ethanol from plant biomass of various sorts than from corn, the least that would be required will be a retrofitting of those plants. And I've heard some discussion that the retrofitting could involve making a big digester stomach, if you will, that would break down the cellulose into the sugars and then put the sugar compounds through the rest of the process. So it may be possible, especially if there's some good forethought in engineering current plants being built, to design them to have this as an add-on feature. And if so, then we wouldn't be wasting all that capital. I would hate to see a lot of capital go into something that wasn't profitable 5 years from now, where then the new money is going to go into something that will drive those out of business. That would be a shame for the rural communities, and it'd just be a waste of resources. So there is a possibility, from what I've heard, of making these big digesters and piggybacking them or putting them in front of the system to provide the feed. I'm hoping that could prove viable and profitable, but I don't know. It's not my area of expertise.
Good. Thank you. In the center here.
The U.S. Farm Bill expires this year, and Colin Peterson, another foremost Minnesotan, is in charge of writing the new one. Yeah. And he's told us that he's going to subsidize the planting or the establishment of 5 million acres of biomass, and he intends to devote public money to provide the market for the interim sale of that until we can get the plants built to use it. Is this the model that he ought to be thinking about?
From everything we know, everything we've seen, we can maximize energy production, maximize carbon sequestration, carbon storage, and minimize growing costs by planting high-diversity mixtures. If you look, for instance, at what the Iowa Extension Agency suggests to farmers who are trying to grow switchgrass for energy, they're suggesting that switchgrass is best if you fertilize it with 110 pounds of nitrogen per acre. Corn often gets like 140, 160, so it's quite a bit of nitrogen. And they say that it has a tendency to be invaded by weeds. High-diversity mixtures drive down soil nutrients to such low levels that weedy plants barely invade them. I mean, they're really very invasion-resistant. And because they're invaded by weeds, their recommendation has been to use pesticides at times, herbicides to be able to control them. And then there are times when you grow things in monoculture that disease becomes a problem that is not a problem in high-diversity mixtures. In high-diversity mixtures, a plant of a given species is far enough away from another plant of that same species that it's hard for a fungal or viral disease to spread from it to its neighbor. I mean, if one of you is sneezing, people within about 10 feet of you are susceptible to whatever you have because you're all the same species. But if you were intermingled different species and you didn't share the same diseases, it wouldn't really matter, right? So the same thing happens in nature. It's a very simple reason why high-diversity communities have less disease. So from everything we know, I sure would like to see a lot of the land going in this direction. But frankly, switchgrass in its own right is an immense improvement over corn. I would be delighted to have 5 million acres of switchgrass. I'd be more delighted, I think it would be wiser, to have a large proportion of that go toward high-diversity. We probably don't have seed to do 5 million acres of high-diversity stuff right now. We could do a lot of it as switchgrass now and add other things later or go have some blended strategy. It needs some more analysis, but I do think we should be pushing toward high-diversity like we're talking about.
Let's go back here.
Professor Tillman, thank you for sharing this very encouraging message. One question I had, since Cedar Creek is so rich in its research on a diversity of species. Has there been any observation, anecdotal or researched on other species such as mammals, birds, insects, reptiles, amphibians, and the variety?
Yes, we've looked at birds, small mammals. Insects are the best thing because we have about 4,500 species of insects. There aren't enough species of small mammals in these small plots. The plots are 30 by 30 feet in size. For insects, we have a highly significant increase in the number of insect species as we increase the number of plant species. We've also looked at very small organisms, soil bacteria and soil fungi, and we have many more species of those in our high diversity mixtures. So the basic story from the organisms where there's enough different species to actually measure diversity responses is that the diversity of the plant community, the diversity of the producers in that ecosystem have effects that affect the diversity of the whole ecosystem. They sort of ramify up and down the food chain and the decomposer chain, higher diversity systems of plants leading to higher diversity of the whole ecosystem.
Question in the front here.
The poplar genome was recently sequenced by Department of Energy. Do you see any place in energy production for poplar in the near future?
Oh, I think there's lots of habitat where woody plants will be the most productive taxa. And right now, we don't know if you get greater production with high diversity mixtures of woody species than with a single species. My guess is you do, because basically the reason that higher diversity systems are more productive is that each species can extract different kinds of the resources. So some trees will leaf out earlier, get light earlier. Some will have deeper roots. Some will have shallower roots, just like prairie grasses are like that. And the very mechanisms, these differences among species that allow them to coexist with each other, are the same exact mechanisms that theory predicts and experiments show cause higher diversity systems to be more productive and more stable and store more carbon. So everything we know about how ecosystems operate leads us to believe that we'll have very much the same benefits from high diversity of woody plants as we have from high diversity of prairie plants. And so until it's tested, we won't know for sure. But as I said, everything that we know points to that that hypothesis.
Let me go back in the corner here.
Your data seem to differ substantially from those of Pimentel at Cornell, both in energy balance and greenhouse gas balance. How do you account for that?
Let me say, David Pimentel is a distinguished ecologist who I admired as a very young scholar. At that time, he was a very distinguished scientist. He still is. The ideas behind his calculations for net energy balance were 20 years ahead of his time. He really was doing full cost accounting when no one else was, and I admire him for that. The dilemma I have with his work is that he has not updated his data. Yields are much better now for corn than they were before. Farmers have become more and more efficient through time. Ethanol factories have become more efficient through time. We basically took the outline of his approach, but we dug up the absolute latest numbers from Department of Energy, from Department of Agriculture, and so on, for national yields and production efficiencies and conversion efficiencies. We met with owners of ethanol factories to find out how much electricity they used to run their plants and had designed plans from we really tried to do this thoroughly, and we gathered the absolute best data we could. We did the analyses, and what we see is that it's very believable that when David Pimentel started doing his work, the things he was saying were correct. Frankly, he hasn't updated it in the last 15 or 20 years, and what he's saying is now out of date.
About in the back of the room here.
With your prairie switchgrass, as compared to, say, ethanol or gasoline, the end product that you come up with, what is the impact, you know, when we're talking about driving a car, for instance, if you can go 20 miles on a gallon of gas or, you know, a gallon and a half of ethanol? Is there more BTU output from your prairie, the high diversity switchgrass compared to ethanol?
There are a couple questions you're raising. I'm not quite sure which one it is. Let me just try to understand it. One thing that you should all know is that a gallon of ethanol only has about 60% of the energy in it of a gallon of gasoline, 60, 65. That means you don't get the same miles per gallon. You end up getting about 60% of the miles per gallon if you burn a gallon of ethanol compared to a gallon of gasoline. So if you go to the pump and you get E85, which is about 85% ethanol, and you pay the same price per gallon that you pay for gasoline, you're getting robbed of 40% of the energy you used to get in that gallon. But when you make ethanol, it doesn't matter what you make it from. It's the same exact chemical compound. Its energy content doesn't matter if it comes from switchgrass or corn or anything else. Ethanol is ethanol, and that's its energy. The same is true if you make synthetic gasoline. Its chemical composition is essentially identical to normal gasoline. That's its energy content.
Three related questions. Is the seed mixture that you're talking about, the diversity one, available? If it is available, where is it available? And if it's not available, is there a recipe?
Let me see. You can buy it from me for $10 million a bushel. Our paper in Science has a supplement. To download the paper, you have to, if you don't have like a university ID which lets you get on, to get these for free. The university has a site license to get all these journals so scientists and students can look at them. You may have to pay $15-$20, but you have to pay nothing to download what's called the supplement. The supplement is another 4 or 5 or 6 pages of material that wouldn't fit into this size of format. That's all the words were allowed, 3 pages. And in that is a list of all the species we planted, how much we use, and so on. Are they available? Many prairie restoration companies sell the seed. Prairie Restoration, Inc. in Princeton, Minnesota. Prairie Moon Nursery is another one we buy seed from. We try to buy local genotypes of seed. They're readily available. I don't think they're ready for what the demand might be, is the real issue. And I think it would take a whole different way of producing seed, the way that we produce corn seed, the way we produce seed right now commercially, let's say in Oregon for lawn grasses and so on. It would take that kind of an effort, which could happen pretty quickly, to make these seeds readily available and at a reasonable price for farmers. That's really what would need to happen. Frankly, right now it's more it's done out of love and novelty and so on. People really want to restore prairie. It hasn't been optimized for efficiency and low price of seeds.
I'm hearing you might only have to mow this once a year then, too, huh, if it's in your yard. Could you speak, since you're holding up this science journal, could you speak a little bit about what the response has been from the scientific community? You talked a little bit earlier about the policymakers.
Right. Well, scientists are wonderful cynics. I'm a wonderful cynic. We all are. And so whenever anything comes out, which is unusual, all of us try to find we think the flaws are in it. And so let me tell you some of the major flaws that people think they see in this. The major one is the assertion that we can do anything with low inputs. And this tends to come from people in agronomy who have, in the last 35 years, have a very proud tradition where they have very high inputs into agriculture, very high yields, were able to double global food production, help the world immensely in doing so. And it's to the point now, 35 or 40 years after that started, where the automatic instinct, I think, for many people in agronomy is it must take a lot of input to do anything. So when we said we would do this with low input, that we'd use legumes to provide all the nitrogen, which is what we're doing, and that we measured how much phosphorus being lost in the plant biomass and said you may have to add phosphorus back, but it's about 6 pounds per acre, which is not very much. But we didn't even add any. I couldn't lie and say we'd added it, so I said we hadn't added any, but the response was, well, you really should be adding it. You should be adding more and so on, which is a very reasonable thing to think from that perspective. So I think that it'll take a while for people in disciplines who are used to sort of the high input, low diversity side to think about the low input, high diversity side and what it might imply. So that's been the major concern. Other ones have been technical questions. We didn't harvest all the biomass. We harvested small strips and sorted and weighed it and so on. Then we burned the plots to get rid of the rest of the biomass. So when you burn the plots, some of the ash goes back on the soil surface, so that might be a sort of a self-fertilizing effect. And that's why I showed you some of the data, which I couldn't fit in the journal Science, by what happened when you actually mowed and removed the biomass from prairie hay for 65 years in a row without any fertilizer going back on and showed that the yields, in fact, were stable. The same thing in this Rothamsted parkgrass experiment, mowed for hay since 1856, twice a year, all the biomass removed. Yields increasing because legumes are becoming more abundant. Cattle ate them beforehand, and they're increasing slowly in time. So all the logic says, and I agree with what the agronomists who criticize this work are saying, in the long term, you have to get some nutrients back in the soil. But it's a lot longer term than I ever imagined it would be when you look at the reality of how little biomass is harvested, and even on the high hay-yielding places I mentioned, the prairie hay and Rothamsted. So those are the concerns that are out there. And I think they're, and it's fun, people care about it. They're thinking deeply. They're probing as deeply as they can. And you can't say a lot in three pages. So lots of stuff that we couldn't say that we now get to say in response to questions.
Well, we know from trying to pin you down for tonight's visit that you've been traveling all around it.
Yeah.
Great demand to come and speak about this to public settings and so forth. So we have a question back in the corner here.
Professor, I'm just curious, now that you've published this paper, what is the next step for you and your research team? What are you working on now? And then also, what could you provide us with some names of other scientists who are working in this field that we should be watching?
Well, I mentioned many at the University of Minnesota. There are others, Lanny Schmidt, who's doing some really interesting work on fuel cells and so on. Kittleson doing work on combustion at this university, at other universities. I really like the Princeton group. They're very creative in what they do. Steve Pakala, Rob Sokolow had a very influential paper in the journal Science several years ago in which they said there are existing technologies that we could apply today, seven different technologies that if they were applied could let us stabilize global climate by stabilizing global emissions of CO2 at present levels and prevent this projected very steep up ramp. In fact, if you saw the movie made from a slide from a PowerPoint that I swore I would never see and loved when I did see it, An Inconvenient Truth, I never, you know, I guess you had to endure a PowerPoint tonight, so I shouldn't feel that bad about it. At the end of the movie, this paper by Pakala and Sokolow is cited because it really is a very optimistic and I think a very realistic scenario. So I would look at them. Other people at Princeton in that group who I really like are Bob Williams and Eric Larson. And in fact, Larson and Williams and another person who's at the NREL, the National Research Environmental Lab, are coming to campus on February 1st for an afternoon symposium. So if you're really interested, send me an email or whatever. We have about 100 slots. About half of them are gone. So, but these are some people whose work I really admire.
Here's another question back in the corner, please.
Professor Tillman, given that some estimates reveal that only 2% of the northern tallgrass prairie ecoregion remains intact, would widespread planting of high biodiversity prairies put those remaining native prairies at risk genetically?
I would say they're a lot genetically at risk. It might be. My basic hypothesis is that, and it will take a lot of experiments to find out if this is true, is that in any given region, the mixture of species that are most likely to perform best for you are likely to be the native genotypes of that region. And so if you're trying to maximize production, I would go back to the results of thousands of years of natural selection and sort of natural breeding going on and find those local genotypes and try to find them and encourage them and plant them in that area. If I look at the ecoregions of the world and grasslands, which have been heavily hit by habitat conversion to farmland and the loss of biological diversity and so on there, which is one of my concerns, I see this as a chance to actually use diversity. It reminds me of my Latin teacher who always told me in high school, David, you either use it or you lose it. Mm-hmm. Well, I hate to tell you, I've lost Latin. but he was very correct in making that assertion. And I think if you look at where the world is going, if we can't have a use for biological diversity, we're going to lose it. It'll be kept as a little curiosity on little tiny bits of land here and there, somebody spending some money to keep around out of some strange love of nature, Ed Wilson's biophilia, if you will. I see this as a chance in which maybe 30 million acres of land in the United States could be restored to fairly diverse habitat, returning those functioning ecosystems and the organisms that live in it, that lived in it, back to that state, and at the same time provide us with a series of benefits that we need. We need the energy it can provide. We need the carbon dioxide removed and stored in the soil. We need cleaner waters. We can have all these things come to us by, if you will, using biological diversity as a tool. There's a reason that the world has 10 million species on it. There's a reason the number of species in the world has been increasing through time. They've been increasing through time because every time a new variant comes up, it can actually come into coexist with the species that are there. You might imagine that the world is all struggle, fight, and one new species comes in and drives something else extinct. But the actual fossil record is one of diversity going up and up and up through time. Things do go extinct, but they rarely go extinct right because something else came in and drove them extinct. the fossil record actually doesn't have things like that in it. That's an incredibly uncommon phenomena. Most species actually coexist with each other. They coexist because they're different. They have trade-offs. They're better at something that nothing else is that good at, that lets them coexist with other things that are better at other things. And they're all, I will say it, if you're better at one thing, you're worse at something else. That's unavoidable in nature. And so I think that using biological diversity, using this incredible capital, if you will, the natural capital of the world to help us solve problems, frankly, is going to be the most efficient way we can solve lots of problems that we now face when there are so many people on Earth.
On that hopeful note, I want to thank you for your years of research on this important important issue. I can't think of any other that's more important to our whole planet than ourselves. Your dedication to training students and then your willingness to come and share it with these hungry folks here tonight who are eager to learn about this. Join me in thanking Professor Tillman.
We'll sing now.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I want to thank you all for coming and the wonderful questions you bring to these events. It just enriches it so much.